Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of the jam-packed shows for you today, Cats and Kittens. The question of the week will examine cinder blocks. We're still not sure how safe or dangerous they are to use, but we're going to tell you exactly what's in them, and you will be shocked and surprised. We're also going to interview the author of a new book about using native plants in your landscape. It's a lot to get done, so let's hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Nicole, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am just ducky today, Nicole. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
And where is Nicole very good?
Well, I'm calling about our weekend house in New Hope, Pennsylvania.
Oh, how beautiful. Well, the New Hope area is sensational.
Yes, we love it. Well, my husband and I bought about a 100-year-old farmhouse a year and a half ago. It's got about a little over an acre of land. It was basically left to its own devices for many years, and it's extremely overgrown. We've been kind of slowly tackling bits and pieces. The wonderful thing about it is that the gentleman who owned it previous to us was an organic gardener.
Right.
And the land is beautiful. It's rich. We have a great in-ground garden, tons of fruit trees, sour cherries, apples, pears, blueberries, wineberries, blackberries. So my question is, where do we start? I mean, we want to try to maintain all of this ourselves, but I think we need a little help. I mean, it's so much, and we love it, and we want to respect the land, and we love the wild beauty of it, but it's a little bit too wild.
You say that you are only spending weekends, not like the whole summer at this place.
No, so we are only there in the weekends.
And where are we coming from?
Brooklyn, New York.
Well, it's just like the sign says as you're leaving Brooklyn. Forget about it.
Okay.
Obviously, all the cane fruits are going to take wonderful care of themselves. All the berries are going to need is for you to pick them. Same thing pretty much with the cherries. The only thing you're going to have to do is hope the birds leave you enough that there'll be something to eat on the weekends. Otherwise, I think you need a hired man.
Okay.
You can't keep a summer garden with vegetables and things like that going, you know, 2 days a week. You kind of need somebody to be there pretty much every day doing a walkthrough. It's treacherous enough to go away for a short vacation in a summer garden.
Well, we have a wonderful landscaper who comes and does the lawn for us, and he's actually helped us clean out some of the more treacherous areas of the property, like the nettles and the poison ivy patches and everything. So,
oh, good.
He does come, and he's great. So, but we did have a garden last year that was extremely successful. We have a huge deer fence.
Good, good.
We just got attacked a little bit by the powdery mildew and, of course, stink bugs.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the stink bug problem is going to be getting lesser and lesser. There are predatory insects being released right now by the USDA, but also our native stink bug predators are moving over to the marmorated stink bug, this new imported pest. So every year going forward, our stink bug problem should be less and less.
That's great.
Here's what I want you to do. As you have problems, I want you to use our show as a resource. Go to youbetyourgarden.org, go to Garden Answers A to Z, click on things like fruit tree care, gnats, stink bugs, powdery mildew. There'll be the answers there. You won't have to go searching, and they've all been fact-checked and researched by us. If you want the other fruit trees, the sour cherries will take care of themselves. It's just a question of you being able to get enough away from the birds, because the birds, they're going to go for the cherries as much as you do. But the other fruit trees are going to require proper care. And it sounds like you could hire the landscaper to do that so that when you show up late on Friday night or early on Saturday morning, you get to kick back and walk around and relax.
I love that idea.
Yeah. If you bought this house for a weekend retreat, you have to keep that mindset. You are not there to work. If work needs to be done, you pick up the phone, you have somebody come and do it. This place has to be your retreat. So, and it, out in the area you are, in New Hope, you probably have some of the most qualified and talented people to take care of your landscape and horticulture for you at your disposal.
Yes, and, you know, we do love to do a lot of it ourselves. It's, you know, who needs CrossFit when you can whack at weeds for an hour? But you're right. It is, you know, a little bit over our heads.
Yeah, exactly. So you farm out, so to speak, as much of the work as possible. And if you want to pick up a weed whacker for fun while you're there, that's your idea of a good time. I'd just be picking and eating the berries, which you're going to have a good time doing soon.
Okay, great.
All right, Nicole?
Well, thank you so much.
All right, good luck.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Frank, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing good, Frank. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I know what you're going to ask me where I'm doing good at, Saltville, Virginia.
All right. What can we do for Frank in Saltville?
I'm having trouble with my strawberries. I'll plant my strawberries, and they done good for a while, but evidently they're not blooming. My plants do really good. I got really nice-looking plants, but they're just not blooming to produce the berries.
So you have a patch of strawberries that you installed years ago?
Well, now I redo them. I take them up and redo them. I got them in a raised bed,
mm-hmm.
and where I'm at, the deer's and all is bad, and I had to put a 10-foot fence around them, and I made a raised bed, and they're in a raised bed 80-foot long by 2-foot wide.
Wow. Oh, man. And no berries?
Yeah, I got about a gallon and a half of berries is all I got this year.
So what did you originally build the raised bed out of? What did you use for the soil? Just your local dirt?
Yeah, and what I done, too, is there's a company that what they do, they go around trimming trees
sure.
for the power line, and I had them dump me about 4 loads on my property,
mm-hmm.
and I let it set about 4 years, and it more or less turned black and turned back just about back into dirt, and I added that to my topsoil. And, of course, I had to rotiller it into the dirt, and then I planted my plants in that.
Okay. Didn't you get a lot of weeds when you tilled?
Well, yeah, but I usually get in there and pull them out.
So in the future, anytime you get a nice load of compost or something like that, don't till the soil. When you till the soil, you release nutrients and you expose weed seeds to the trigger for germination. So tilling actually takes nutrients out of the soil and gives you nothing but weed problems. And as you know, in a big strawberry bed, weeds are your worst enemy.
Yeah.
So you've never added any kind of actual fertilizer, chemical or organic?
Well, I listen to your show quite a bit, but the past 2 things that that I heard on your show, it come just a little bit too late. I had a black heart cherry tree, and I added 10-10-10 to it. And killed it, and I wondered what happened. Then I heard on your show so many months later, don't put 10-10-10 on fruit trees. It's murder.
Yep, that's right. Yeah. Well,
and
at least I
killed it. But I did take a soil sample where my strawberries is, and they said I needed nitrogen.
No, that's completely wrong. Because you say you have big plants, right?
Yeah.
That's what nitrogen gives you. Nitrogen, that's the first 10 in 10-10-10. That actually inhibits flowering. If you want to buck up any nutrients, what you want is rock phosphate. Do you know how on like your 10-10-10 or any fertilizer, there's 3 numbers?
Yeah.
First one is nitrogen, second one is phosphorus, third one is potassium. That middle number, the phosphorus, that's quote, the flowering nutrient. That's the nutrient that encourages plants to put on a lot of blooms, and then, if it's that kind of a plant, to allow those flowers to become fruits. Rock phosphate is the most natural form of phosphorus you're going to find, and a little bit goes a long way. I'd say only about a cupful per 20 feet of your row. How's that?
Okay.
You know, and you only need to do it every 3 to 5 years. It persists in the soil.
Okay.
Are there any hip garden centers near you? I mean, any kind of independent garden centers, not a big box store?
Yes, yeah, they are.
You know, the people who make Holytone, Espoma,
uh-huh,
they have a new line of liquid fertilizers, one of which is actually called Bloom. I'm playing with it at home. Liquid is going to give you a chance of activating the phosphorus this season. If you were to mix that as directed and give your strawberries a couple of feedings with it, that's the kind of phosphorus they can absorb into their system right away. But I also want you to get a bag of rock phosphate and dust it around the plants, and that will be for next year.
Okay. All right.
All right. Good luck, Frank.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate all the info.
Take care.
Oh, thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce my fall tour dates. I'll appear at the Delaware Home Show in Newark on Saturday, September 10th, at the Spring City Library on Friday evening, September 30th, and my version of Vegas, the Fredericksburg, Virginia Home and Garden Show on October 15th and 16th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with native plants, cinder blocks, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we will actually give definitive answers to the question, are there cinders in cinder blocks? People who want to build raised bed frames want to know, and we found out for them. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Lynn Steiner, author of the new book, Grow Native, Bringing Natural Beauty to Your Garden. It's new from Cool Springs Press. Lynn joined us on a previous show speaking about rain gardens. Lynn, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. Now, you've got a very interesting book here filled with different native plants. I think a lot of the plants in the book will surprise people because I think some people have an expectation that native plants are drab things that they normally don't see around. And obviously, it's a great idea to really point out the winners. But we're going to ask you to do something very special in this interview, something we've rarely tried before. In our list of phone calls for today's show, we have a woman named Kristen from Franklinville, New Jersey, who has a clear open space that is a very natural space with no landscaping, and she's asking me what plants to put in. Well, if there's one thing I'm terrible at, it is doing landscaping, doing garden design. When people ask me what should they plant, it's like, shouldn't you be asking me also what to name your child and what state you should live in? I really don't feel I have any skills there. But if you're up for it, we're going to bring her on and let's have you suggest some native plants to decorate this space she has.
Okay, I'm game.
All right. Kristen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden and our guest, Lynn Steiner.
Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Lynn. Hi, Mike.
So how you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day, and I'm happy to be here.
And explain to Lynn whereabouts you live. I know you live in New Jersey. What part?
So I live in southern New Jersey, not the Pine Barrens, but it's probably an hour west of Philadelphia or east of Philadelphia.
And it's a typical mid-Atlantic climate.
Yeah, yep.
So now you had an interesting experience. You just moved into this house and the backyard had to be stripped or something?
Right. So before we moved in, a whole new septic system had to be put in. Whatever was there, whatever moss or grass was covering the ground is gone, and a good deal of trees are gone in our backyard. So now we have kind of an open space that has just been, they've just put some grass seed down. But other than that, there's no landscaping to speak of. The property is partly wooded. It's all wooded in the front, and it backs up to a really gorgeous forest as far as you can see back.
All right. So, Lynn, what do you think?
Well, Kristen, is the site that you're wanting to garden actually on top of the septic mound or the septic field?
Some of it is, and some of it isn't.
Okay. Because you do have to be careful about gardening over a septic mound or a septic field. And a lot of people do ask me about that. And actually, there are a lot of native plants that do well on top of a septic mound or in a field. What you're looking for is you want to make sure that it's something that is shallow rooted. So you want to stay away from the woodies, trees and shrubs, mm-hmm. and the very deep tap-rooted herbaceous plants. But there are a lot of prairie plants that are fibrous-rooted and actually are very good in that kind of situation because they grow well in the sandy, sometimes even gravelly soil that's usually in the field. And they also tend to tolerate higher soil pH, which you often find in these areas because of some of the chemicals that are leaching out and raising the soil pH. I just want to caution you to be very careful. Don't dig down too deeply in this area. Don't use a rototiller, that sort of thing. It sounds like maybe you actually have bare dirt right now. Is that the case? Or
We have just the beginnings of a lawn. It's okay. Sort of like young grass.
Yeah, but okay. if Lynn, you know, if they sowed the lawn this spring, it's going to die on its own. You're going to have a clean slate.
We're obviously going to encourage you to not go with the lawn and go with some plants that we think are going to be a lot better for habitat.
I would love that.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So just know that when you are directly working over the septic area, be careful. Wear gloves. You know, the soil can have some contaminants in it. What you want to do is you want to get in there and plant it, and then plant it with things that you can sort of just leave it, because you don't want to be tending that a lot and spending a lot of time out there. You don't even really want to be going over it with a lawnmower. So some of the things, the prairie plants that would do well in that sunny area would be some of the fibrous-rooted grasses, such as little blue stem and prairie drop seed, two of my very favorite native grasses. And then nodding wild onion is a nice little tough little herbaceous plant that looks very nice for a good part of the summer.
Now, I'm gonna interrupt there because I was looking through the book, and nodding onion is like simply a native version of what we call ornamental alliums, kind of a cross between an allium and a fritillaria. It's the last kind of spring bulb thing to bloom, so it takes over after all the tulips are shot. And it has these beautiful pendulous flowers that come down just at a time before a lot of other stuff hasn't really come into flower yet.
Right, kind of in that in-between area between spring and summer. So, yes, they're very good for bringing that color at that time. And a lot of insects like the pollen, and then it's attractive to some butterflies. And then the seeds are also food for some birds later. So a lot of value in that sense. Any of the Coreopsis, our native Coreopsis would do well there, Coreopsis grandiflora or lanceolata. Purple mm-hmm. cone flower, the flowering spurge, this is a Euphorbia corollata, would do great there. Very drought tolerant, has a nice little white flower for most of the summer.
Lynn, these are great ideas for near the field. They're not going to hurt the piping or anything like that. How about as we get closer to the woods? Are you going to change the plants then?
Sure. Once you get off that septic, you know, the area that I'm worried, you know, talking about, the sky's the limit. Then I don't see any reason why any native plant couldn't work. So here again, going back to how much you want to put into the maintenance and the care and that sort of thing, and if you want to stick with things that are a little bit clump-forming, more well-behaved, some of my favorites for just tough, long-season bloom are Anise hyssop. I love Amsonia blue star. Of course, butterfly milkweed is always at the top of the list because of its attractiveness to monarch butterflies and because it's a very pretty plant. I love blue false indigo. I mentioned purple cone flowers. For later in the season, I love asters and helenium or sneezeweed. Lots of choices. And then, of course, as you get closer into the woodland, then you want things that tolerate a little bit more shade. So you can look at your ferns. I love maidenhair fern. It's a very well-behaved fern and beautiful texture. I love wild ginger for just getting in there and covering the ground. Bleeding hearts, Bowman's root does very well in where Kristen lives. The phloxes, woodland phlox, bloodroot, foam flower, so many beautiful plants that give you a tapestry of foliage colors and textures. I will say, living where you live, I'm very jealous. I would recommend that you get to Bowman's Hill Wildflower Preserve and also to Mount Cuba Center. They're both in eastern Pennsylvania, and they just, both of them have beautiful areas where they've gardened with native plants, and you can really get some good ideas there.
Those are two great local resources. And I'll add that I was just over somebody's house the other day who had a lovely kind of different level pond filled with frogs and toads. And beyond that was the woods. And in between was this big run of bleeding hearts. And it was just absolutely perfect.
Yeah, yeah, very nice. And then, of course, shrubs. There are a lot of native shrubs that would do well, especially, I wouldn't put them here again over the septic area, but along the edges and especially that transition into the woodland. Some of the native service berries, which are amelanchier species. I love oak leaf hydrangeas. They can tolerate a little bit of shade. And our native azaleas make a beautiful understory for taller trees. So a lot of choices going into that transition area.
All right, Kristen, we got your head spinning?
Yeah, a lot of great ideas. I'll be going over everything, and I have a lot of exciting things ahead of me this summer, it looks like.
All right, Kristen, thank you so much. I urge you to take a look at Lynn's book, Grow Native. And Lynn, I have to say, that's absolutely brilliant, sending her to Bowman's Hill and to Mount Cuba. Take a notebook and extra pens with you.
Right.
Well, thanks so much.
Favorite public gardens. Yeah. Good luck.
All right. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
All right. We are talking with Lynn Steiner, the author of the new book, Grow Native, Bringing Natural Beauty to Your Garden. She was just a good sport in helping me answer a phone call. Lynn, let's talk about a couple of those plants that we were discussing, and a couple other of my favorites. I mean, service berries. Is this like the most underutilized native plant in America?
it may well be, yes. Yes, they're great landscape plants. They very delicate texture. They're not a heavy tree. They can be shrubs or trees, actually, very easily pruned into small trees. I like them that way. I have several in my yard. I love them because of that early spring bloom, even before the leaves are completely unfolded. You get the white flowers, and then they are one of the first genera to set fruit in summer. So you get tons of birds coming in. Here in Minnesota, it's late June into early July. Where you are, it would probably be mid-June. And so a good early food source for birds, and then the beautiful
and humans.
Color.
Humans.
And humans can also eat service berries. That's right.
So let's just spend a second here. The difference between a native plant, a cultivar of a native plant, and a, quote, exotic plant. I'm guessing that it's the cultivar is still got the bones of the native plant. And is there ever a case where the cultivar goes a little too far and does not provide the food or pollen that the species did?
Definitely. A prime example of that are the poor purple coneflowers that have just... The breeders have just gone crazy with them and turned them into these weird-looking, fringy, wild-colored plants when the pure species is just so beautiful as it is. And it's an interesting topic that you bring up, because there is a lot of work starting to be done on it, is are these native cultivars, or nativars as some people are using, but I don't understand why. They're native plants that are cultivars of native plants. Are they still as valuable to our native fauna? And some cases they are. I just saw a study where in some cases there are a few cultivars that are even more attractive to certain insects and butterflies. And in some cases, they're just not. Most cases, the pure species is still more attractive. But it's I deal with reality, and for people who I would rather have people use native plants, use cultivars of native plants that work in their situation and they don't get frustrated with them and want to rip them out, than to go looking for the exotic plants that aren't native to North America or to their area. And those are the plants that I worry more about gardeners using in their garden.
It occurs to me as I look through your book a little more carefully that I'm not remembering a lot of native plant books that have separate sections on beyond the species, on the cultivars.
Right, right. Well, you know, I come to this topic from a gardening standpoint. I'm trained as a horticulturist, but in my 30 years of gardening, I've learned a lot. I've learned that gardening isn't always such a green hobby. And I try very hard to become what I call a responsible gardener. And so I appreciate that people want to try new plants. They want to add different things to their garden every year and experiment and that sort of thing. But I just caution everyone to do it with thought, and giving thought to every time they put a new plant into their garden. What could this plant be doing to the world beyond our garden? Because our gardens don't stop at the border of our property. Seeds move, birds move seeds, and plants move, and then they have repercussions in our natural areas.
Now, do you think that a lot of people would be surprised to know that the redbud is a native tree? I mean, it's used so often. It's certainly not underutilized. I often wonder if people think it's some exotic import.
Right. It does have a look of that with those hot pink flowers in spring. Yeah, I do think a lot of people don't realize how many of our traditional landscape plants are actually native plants. So I am always pleased when people find that out and the light bulb goes on and they're excited that they're already using some native plants.
And the magnolia, you could have devoted a whole book to the different types of magnolias, right?
Yes, magnolias, yes. We do have a lot of native species of magnolias. Mm-hmm.
Now,
very
you
nice.
Chose to focus on the cucumber magnolia.
Chose to focus, the way the book is set up, I had to pick one species to sort of start off the magnolia chain. But with magnolias, with oaks, with pines, it's really hard to choose one species over the other.
Just that you're from the frozen north, from like Minnesota, that you didn't choose the southern magnolia?
The southern magnolia is also a nice plant. It's kind of a large plant for most landscape situations. So here again, I was trying to be more practical and zero in on plants that will fit a wide variety of landscape situations.
And we could go on forever and ever, but...
We could.
My producer will keep throwing herself at the glass until we stop. Uh-huh. So we've been talking to Lynn Steiner, author of the new book, Grow a Native, Bringing Natural Beauty to Your Garden, new from Cool Springs Press. Lynn, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden again.
You are very welcome.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody with a cool season lawn, that's bluegrass or fescue, that we are now officially in the no feeding zone until mid to late August. Also, don't cut cool season grasses during a dry heat wave. And if you need to water them, make it deep and infrequent. No more than once a week. Maybe twice if the devil drops by to ask, is it hot in here? But don't go looking for the reasons under L for lawn care in the A to Z Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with cinder blocks and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a few minutes, we'll get to the question of the week. Are there still cinders in cinder blocks? We will reveal what we learned after investigating for weeks about the exact composition of those ubiquitous blocks. What we found will shock, surprise, and inform you. And that's coming up after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sharon, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am just ducky today. Sharon, how are you?
Well, I'm wonderful. I'm sitting on the porch of my log house watching the hummingbirds feed.
Oh, so very good.
Be better. And I have ceiling fans as well because it's so humid here.
Okay, and where is it humid?
Oh, by Helia, Mississippi.
Vahalia.
Vahalia.
So what can we do for Sharon in Mississippi?
Well, I have gardenias that are just limping along, mostly in the shade under the overhang of my front porch.
Right.
And I have a huge gardenia that's as big as a full-size truck that's in full sun to the east of my porch. It is just growing like mad, even though I do nothing to it. But no matter what I do to these that are in mostly shade, they're pitiful, absolutely pitiful. Hardly any growth, a lot of dead canes, no blooms, if any. And I was wondering if I could dig them up this time of year and move them forward maybe a foot or so that they could be in full sun and hopefully grow up like the big brother on the other end of the porch.
Well, we are probably into the worst 2 months for you to do that. And of course, every time you go outside, you see them and you think of nothing else, right? There's no way
right.
you cannot think of the elephant in the corner of the
mm-hmm.
room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, the God's honest answer is the best time to do this is coming up, but it's probably going to be in September or October. Now,
okay.
where you are, what kind of a winter do you get? What's the coldest you can remember, or what's the normal coldest?
The normal coldness is 35, 40.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. So, because you say these things also need cleaning up, they need pruning and everything like that. So, if you were somewhere that had colder winters, you wouldn't have gardenias growing outside. Do you realize how many people are jealous? You know, the one of the hardest house plants to keep alive. There's poor people in the north who cart them outside and walk them around in strollers like babies for the summer and then bring them inside and weep over them. And you say you've got one that's the size of a truck.
But I only buy hardy because, I mean, living in zone 7B, sometimes our winters can come ice storms.
Right.
And before the winter, the really bad winter sets in, we wrap these in, you know, like that clear plastic, like really thick millimeter, just to help them because the freeze has, ice has killed some of them.
Yeah.
A good amount.
You know, I would not use plastic. Because on a sunny day that can actually heat up the plants artificially, something that breathes like burlap is going to be much better for the plants and not accidentally cause more winter damage. Here's what I'm going to suggest you do in the future. Don't put anything onto the plants. They don't need it, and it can crush them and or concentrate the heat of the sun. Drive some tall stakes into the ground around the plants and then wrap burlap up as high as you can around the stakes. Don't worry about the top of the plant. No matter what you do, the top of the plant is probably going to suffer some winter damage in a cold winter, right?
Yes.
So don't worry about it. But if you can make a windbreak and a heat sink out of burlap around the plant going up like for the first 6 feet, that's the best winter protection you can give them without harming them. Now, because you've told me about these possible cold winters, I'm going to change my timing. I think that you should dig these things up and move them in the spring. After all chance of frost is done when they're growing new growth, because then you can prune off any winter damage from all of your plants, move the new plants to the new location, and they're going to take off like crazy. But if you do it now, the heat stress will absolutely kill them. I mean, there's almost no chance that they would survive.
Oh.
This is the only time of year you can't move anything, especially where you are.
I don't want to lose them because they're right here straight in front of me, you know, under the drip, the overhang of the house.
Right. So you have to do the hardest thing in the gardening world, which is just have patience. Don't look at them. Maybe put up like a sign in front of them, a poster, something to distract your attention. And then go to the burlap this winter. You'll never regret that. And then in the spring, after they're all growing again, move them, and it'll be like they won't even know they were moved.
Okay.
All right?
I'll try that.
All right. Good luck, Sharon.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure. You take care and stay cool.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for taking my question today.
Well, thank you for asking it, I hope. Where are you, Bill?
In my RV, crossing the country to a new home I purchased in the Central Valley of California.
Wow.
You hit the base of the Sierras.
You hit the lottery or something?
No, just a lot of hard work.
And where are we RVing away from?
Ortley Beach, New Jersey, with the Jersey Shore.
All right.
Well, I always grew lots of tomatoes in New Jersey and in my house in Cocoa Beach, Florida, on the East Coast. No problems, plenty of rain. But where I'm heading to now, it's dry, hot, and there's restrictions on watering.
Well, when you were in Cocoa Beach, I'm presuming that you learned to not be seriously growing during July and August, that with the climate you had, you treated summer like we treat winter and just took a break and hid inside under the air conditioning.
Exactly. Grew tomatoes in Jersey in the summer and grew tomatoes in the other seasons in Florida.
Right. So you're going to follow the Florida seasons in California.
Yeah.
And you are going to be living in a house, right?
Yes, and I'll be putting raised gardens similar to the ones I had in Cocoa Beach.
Okay. So, years ago, this was controversial and in many cases illegal. But with the current water situation in California, I don't think you will have any trouble installing what's called a gray water system. This is
a gray water system.
Gray. White water is what comes into your house. Gray water is what leaves your house, not your toilets. That's a whole other schmigeggy, so to speak, but your shower water, your sink water, your washing machine water.
Exactly.
All of that can be diverted. And what happens, and people misunderstand how to use gray water. It must be applied to the plants at the time it leaves the house. For instance, you will set up a system, you know, gravity-fed, hopefully, although there are pumps available for this. You know, you'll filter it a little bit just to make sure your system doesn't get clogged up. But what will happen is it will go into a holding tank, but it will not be held in the tank because there's going to be food particles and little bits of soap in there. It would quickly become what's called black water. It would go bad. But as it leaves your shower, as it leaves your washing machine, it's perfectly safe. So the holding tank just slows it down, and then you'll have drip irrigation lines that go out to your garden, which you will also protect by having a good layer of mulch on the surface of the soil with the drip lines underneath the mulch that will maintain the least amount of evaporation and to keep the moisture in the soil. You'll be able to find lots of information online. Permaculture sites will have this all over the place. Gray water sites are out there. A dear old friend of mine, Robert Couric, wrote a book about this many years ago, but the laws were all different then. However, his systems are still perfectly appropriate. If you want, you'll check to see if it's legal, but it's not that hard to do, and nobody's going to give you a hard time for using your water correctly in California. And depending on how much water you use in your house, you should be able to keep, you know, a good-sized garden well-watered. You'll never actually have to go out and water your plants. You'll water them every time you take a shower or use the bathtub or use the sink or the washing machine. Try to avoid doing it in the heat of the day because the plants are closed up tight, and especially during a hot and dry spell, you want to time that big water use to be in the morning or the evening. And there's no problem with evening watering when you're watering the root system because you won't be wetting the leaves of the plants.
How pricey is this system?
No, I mean, you can build it yourself.
Oh, okay.
All right, Bill?
Thank you. That's all I can say. I'll keep listening.
All right. All right. You enjoy your winters and survive your summers.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Are there still cinders in cinder blocks? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. Wanda in Scappoose, Oregon, 20 miles north of Portland, writes, "A couple of years ago, I started rereading my old organic gardening magazines from when you were the editor, which led to me finding your podcasts. I've been listening ever since. Now I have a question. Are cinder blocks safe to use to make raised beds? My daughter would like to use them for this purpose, but the information, pro and con, on the internet is confusing and unconvincing. Is there really a risk of the substances used in making the blocks leaching into a raised bed? In the Pacific Northwest, we get a lot of precipitation, which can cause a lot of leaching. I told her that I would trust your opinion. Thank you for continuing to help keep our world safe. P.S. I was one of those subscribers who had to fight to get the issue with the infamous comic book cover away from my kids." Ha! Did you really use a comic book cover on a gardening magazine?
Yep. Way back in 1992. I had gotten my old friend Stan Lee to come speak to the entire Rodale staff, and we did a tribute to the cover of Fantastic Four number one in his honor. The response was crazy. We got write-ups in all the national magazines. Now, about those so-called cinder blocks.
So-called?
Well, cinder block is a somewhat archaic and generic term for a type of structural block that can be made out of a lot of different things. When people burned coal to heat their homes, and places like Bethlehem Steel had enormous coke ovens going 24/7, they produced a lot of, quote, cinders. Another generic term, this time for the ash left behind when coal or similar fuels are burned. As with wood stove ash today, a typical winter would leave a homeowner with several trash cans worth of cinders. And coal-fired power plants and steel mills would produce tons of this waste every day.
So it was used to make cinder blocks?
Right. These were, and in some cases still are, the same shape and size as concrete blocks, but with industrial waste as the aggregate instead of the sand or fine gravel you would use to make true concrete.
Right. You explained a while back that the difference between concrete and cement is that concrete is the result when filler material is held together with cement. So those big trucks with the constantly rotating cylinders are actually concrete trucks and not cement trucks.
Exactly right. And even though true cinder blocks are in the minority today, somebody looking at a pile of what might more properly be called masonry units or breeze blocks is much more likely to call them cinder blocks than concrete block.
But it's only old blocks that actually contain cinders, right?
No, you can still find cinders in new blocks. As long as there are coal-fired power plants around, a company that makes concrete forms near such a plant can still use the leftover ash to make true cinder blocks.
Then how can you tell the difference between a cinder block and a concrete block?
Weight and strength. I spoke to dozens of people in the trade about this confusing topic, and everybody agreed that true cinder blocks are much lighter than concrete block, that true concrete is heavier, more durable, and longer lasting.
So today's builders must only want concrete block.
It's what you would think, wouldn't you? But that's not true. If the building codes and structural needs of the job allow it, many builders actually prefer, quote, cinder block because it's so much lighter. Real concrete blocks are onerously heavy, and lifting them up gets old fast. So believe it or not, modern cinder block, which is made using volcanic pumice if there isn't a coal plant nearby, can actually command a higher price.
Wow. Okay, so what about the safety question?
Man, it is, as our listener states, endlessly debated. the aggregate in any kind of block is going to be bound up pretty tightly. So the main concern here might more realistically be about the cement that's common to all these objects. Cement is made from lime, which is highly caustic and alkaline in its basic form. Objects made with cement have the potential to raise your soil's pH, especially in areas that have acidic soil and/or lots of rain. One overwhelming piece of advice I found that was, whatever you do, don't use block near acid-loving plants like blueberries.
So what can we tell this mother and daughter?
Well, if the block is new and heavy, it's concrete that was made with sand or gravel. It's not cinders. If it's old and light, it's probably mostly coal waste. If it's new and light, and you're buying it new, the seller will be able to tell you exactly what's in it. But the bottom line for me is these blocks are ugly. They make the least attractive possible frames for raised beds. They may hold the soil in place, but it's always going to look like you're one step away from starting a collection of abandoned cars nearby. Well, that sure was some interesting information about blocks that might be cinder now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to articles with lots more raised bed framing options, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to concrete my block if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you're sure that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where we don't care about your location. And where you'll find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar are our internet blockheads. Our eminently erudite intern is Emma Bixler. Dependable as concrete, Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Cindery Al Banks is our editor. I'm structurally sound Mike McGrath, although my exact composition continues to be unknown, but it is durable enough that I'll see you again next week. The Zika virus has taken mosquitoes from outdoor annoyance to fearsome foe. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll review the plants you can grow to use as mosquito repellent, plus answers to all your growing questions.